colonialism is clearly an area in which this is true. Both Malik and Romulo, come to their human rights through their experience with forms of U.S. empire. Obviously, Romulo in the American Philippines. Malik himself is a product of the American missionary education system throughout the Near East, the AUB, a PhD in philosophy from Harvard. But both of them, rather than simply repudiating the colonial project, represent themselves as having transcended it. And so in many ways, they're looking to move this process of transformation forward through the human rights system. I have more. The same thing is true for the NGOs as well. The CSOP, for instance, right? The members of the CSOP are primarily these veterans of the fight for the League of Nations, and who very much want to simply reform rather than completely revision the way international organizations are modeled coming into the 1940s from the interwar period. Okay, so let me get to the last section, and for me this is the most interesting and probably the most sketchy and least satisfying. But I think what's particularly interesting about the 1940s is the way in which they help us to understand the relationship between human rights and universality, right? The way in which universality works, not as a cloak for particularisms and provincialisms, not simply as a mask for asserting very specific agendas, but rather as a process, as a methodology in which particular ideas, particular perspectives, particular agendas get articulated into the wider world. And I don't know if the cascade is right, but it's certainly true that part of the inner logic of human rights is that they have to open up, that in articulating things at a universal register, it requires a fundamental change in the particular nature of what you're asking. So, Romulo's effort to generalize the Philippine pattern meant for him, on the one hand, the development of an international convention for freedom of information. In articulating it as a global convention, however, right, it changes from being simply a reproduction of American-style free press, free speech protections to ones that both include these free speech protections and demand this notion of press responsibility, in which the national dignity of smaller third world states are protected against the ideological and cultural hegemony of large media institutions based in the West. I also think that it also becomes a place where we can begin to think about the relationship between history itself and universality. That in this quest to historicize human rights, again, our intent shouldn't be to demonstrate how human rights have failed to be fully universal, how they have excluded people. They will always exclude people. How could it be otherwise than that they would apply to particular people in particular places in particular times, and not certain people in certain places and certain times? But to understand, rather, the way in which an engagement with history can help us understand this process of universalization, the way in which it unfolds. It breaks against, it breaks through certain barriers, but fails to break through other barriers, and that universality functions as a mode of historical being, a historical process itself. So, thanks.
Thank you, Glenn. I'm going to speak very, very briefly, because I'd like us to try to break at 11:30. But first, I just want to say, Glenn, your papers seem very, very finished to me. Despite your protests in the future. I have to see what a finished lead paper is like.
Sure, sure, yeah. Not much different.
Okay. So you have two papers who are, in part, the same historical remit. This period right after the end of the Second World War, when a tremendous amount of flux in terms of population flows in Europe, a great deal of debate at home in the United States about human rights and the concentration of American power at the end of the Second World War, helping shape, both through the United States government and American non-governmental organizations, the shape of human rights. Now, what I'm gonna lay a pretty strong challenge to Pam's paper at the outset, which is that I am having a difficult time, not just with your work, my own work, seeing how refugee policy fits with the origins of human rights. In fact, I see, I work on the Nansen passports in the interwar period, in which the only people who were afforded any kind of refugee status were Armenians and denationalized Russians. And so for me, the history of the refugee is nothing but a history of exclusion and not about articulating any form of right for the refugee, but rather entitlements and protective regimes and so on. And the story that you tell about the sort of this, and I say this in a negative way, but sort of the detritus of Italian colonialism coming home, strikes me more as a conversation about national citizenship rights than it does intersect with emerging ideas about, international ideas about the refugee. Now, that's not to say that something happens after 1951 in refugee theory where it's no longer about groups of refugees, but the individual refugee becomes a bearer of some kind of rights. And I think that we're at a very early moment in the study of this, and you know, we go down several different paths. But again, I want to challenge a little bit. I want to help ask you to sort of elaborate a little bit more how this links up and how what's happening in 51 is different than what was happening, you know, in 1922. Glenn, I mean, this is a great paper because it shows how multi-layered human rights history is. I mean, you've got the same paper with, you know, talking about the NAACP and Charles Malik, an American University in Beirut graduated, undergraduate, and essentially a Filipino freedom fighter in the same paper. I mean, the marvelous scope that human rights history avails the historian is just really impressive. But what I wanted to do is see if I could push you a little bit on the sort of interplay between the NAACP and the ABA. In that the NAACP really very early saw the power of the United Nations and the rhetoric of Americanism as both a kind of form to foster a kind of decolonization at home and abroad, and the ABA was just scared to death of this.